just false. This can't be true. Not only is it false, it's also incoherent. This is false because the city-soul analogy on the side of the city implies that there would be a class of citizens, these bronze-souled people, who are completely bereft of reason. You remember the structure: gold, reason; silver, spirit; bronze, desire. Well, these three parts are separated from each other. How, Williams asked, could there be a human being who doesn't have reason? Would a human being without reason even be human? No. That's Williams' answer. Even if it were possible remotely to conceive as some human beings as being irrational, it would be incoherent still to postulate the city-soul analogy on the side of the city. Now, why is that? Because who are these bronze-souled people? They are the people who receive orders from the gold-souled people, the rulers, the guardians. But in order to receive an order, you must be rational. I can't order a turtle to do something. I can make a turtle do something by physically forcing it to, but I can't issue a command and expect a turtle to obey me. Why? A turtle seems to be irrational. If these bronze-souled people are so irrational, how will they follow orders? Hence, Williams concludes that the tripartite division, the city-soul analogy, is fatally flawed. The same problem would infect the city-soul analogy on the side of the individual. Because inside each individual, as we just discussed, there are three parts. One of those parts is desire. Well, the same problem emerges right away. How can reason, the first and presumably best part of a human being, how can reason order around desire if desire is not the least bit rational? How could desire accept the commands? There's a problem when it comes to reason as well. Reason, because it's so separated from desire, has no real impetus to give commands. When I give a command to you, I do so because I want you to accomplish something for me. If I had no desires, how could I issue a command? It's desire that's the impetus in human activity. But reason, on the tripartite model, is bereft of desire. Hence, it has no impetus. Again, William makes this a criticism of the city-soul analogy and the general tripartite scheme. I think William's critique is very powerful. Nonetheless, I would urge you to think somewhat more sympathetically about the tripartite psychology and the tripartite division in the city. And let me express this in rather casual terms, not formal argumentative terms. Isn't it true that you have behaved just like Leontius? Didn't you ever get really mad at yourself because, for example, you ate a third piece of chocolate cake when you knew it was bad for you? Isn't that exactly the way you would describe the experience? And don't you yell at yourself afterwards? But even think about that very ordinary phrase, "I got mad at myself." That very phrase suggests that we do, in fact, divide ourselves up. I, my reason, got mad, my spirit, at myself, my desires. Leontius curses his eyes. After you eat that third piece of chocolate cake, you might curse your eyes. Again, that's a very casual way to put the point. I'm not sure by itself it surmounts the objections of Bernard Williams. However, I think it lends some credence to the tripartite psychology. Let me now do the same exercise when it comes to the city. The city has three parts. One part is gold, one part is bronze. This is a very disturbing image. It suggests that there's a class of citizens that only obeys orders and is virtually bereft of reason. As usual, now, in our study of the Republic, you may have been made uncomfortable by this. Nonetheless, I urge you to try to think about it a little bit sympathetically again. And here's the reason why. Isn't it true that we would very much welcome a ruler who has knowledge? That is exactly what's postulated by the tripartite political system. One of the most disturbing things about politics, and particularly democratic politics, the politics of America, the politics of ancient Athens, is that rulers are chosen by the majority. The key to political success in a democracy is to win over the population. There is no knowledge requirement put on a successful politician in a democracy. What democracy, therefore, is, and this is a foreshadowing of Socrates' very explicit criticism of democracy, which will occur much later in the Republic, democracy is rule by opinion, not by knowledge. What I think is accomplished by the division of the city into three parts is a reminder of how greatly we would, in fact, welcome rule by knowledge. With this, Socrates has, he believes, fulfilled his task of explaining what justice is and why it's preferable for both city and individual. He's next prepared to move to the next stage of the analysis, which is a discussion of unjust regimes. But before he gets to do that, he is interrupted, and that will take us to the beginning of Book 5.
Lecture 9, Book 5, Feminism.
At the end of Book 4, Socrates seems to have completed his mission. His mission was to construct a city that was just, and by means of doing this, he was able, or so he claimed, to answer the question, what is justice? And the second question, why is a life of justice better than a life of injustice? Once again, he seems ready to go home, but he is interrupted. Adeimantus, who perhaps you recall is Plato's brother, says to him, wait a minute, and I'm going to paraphrase lines 449c. You said to us, Socrates, that men and women will live in common, that the family structure that we have always lived with will be abolished. This is an extraordinary proposal that you, Socrates, treated as if it were a simple, casual change in policy. In fact, it's extraordinarily radical, and it must be addressed. If you turn back to 423e, you'll see where Socrates makes this proposal in Book 4. Socrates is arrested, and of course that's a playful term. He's not literally arrested. This is, however, the way the young men who are surrounding him describe what they're doing. They stop him from going any further, and they force him to address the issue of women, of children, of sexual relationships. Socrates is willing to do this, and he says he will organize his remarks around a metaphor. And the metaphor is of the famous three waves. This is a metaphor that's borrowed from Greek nautical lore. The notion was that on the ocean, waves come in a series of three. and they are increasing in volume. The third wave is the most intense wave. Socrates claims that he must swim through three waves in order to fully address the question that Adeimantus demands that he address, the issue of sexual relationships. The first wave, and here I refer to 451D, is that men and women must perform the same tasks in the city. Men and women will both be soldiers and both will be rulers and guardians. In order to fulfill their tasks, they must have the same education. This was, to say the least, a revolutionary idea in the 4th century, especially in Athens, which of all the Greek cities seems, at least according to some scholars, to have been one of the most hostile to women. You might think, for example, of the legend of the Amazons, the famous female warriors. The Athenians depicted the Amazons often in their sculptures, but they always depicted the Amazons being killed. So imagine living in a city where the imagery is filled with the view of men killing women. I think that suggests the level of hostility to women that was often found in Athens. Plato, as we're going to see, is a massive exception to this rule. In the first wave, he is going to open up the doors to women to occupy any position that a man could occupy in his city. And of course, by his city, I mean the perfectly just or ideal city. Why does he say this? Does he have an argument to back it up? Of course he does. He's a philosopher. Philosophers don't simply make assertions or tell you their opinions. They, at least they should, try to back up what they have to say with argument. And Socrates' argument centers around the idea of human nature. He believes that to be human is to be someone who is capable of learning. You might look for this point at 455b. Another way to put this point is to say that for Socrates, there is an essential quality that goes along with being human. Let me just explain exactly what I mean by an essential quality. This is a very traditional distinction that philosophers make between essential qualities and what they call accidental qualities. Socrates himself gives an example of an accidental quality when he talks about the difference between men who are bald and men who have long hair. Being bald or being long-haired is merely an accidental feature of being human. One can be bald and still be a human being. One can have long hair and still be a human being. It's a quality, yes, but it's not one that goes to the heart, to the essence of being human. By contrast, an essential quality does just that. It goes right to the heart of being human. If you are human, you have this quality, and if you don't have this quality, you're not human. For Socrates, the essential quality of being human is being able to learn, being rational, being able to acquire knowledge. And he argues that there's nothing in a woman's nature that in any way disadvantages them when it comes to learning. Therefore, there's nothing in a woman's nature that in any way makes her inferior to a man when it comes to those essential qualities of being human. Men typically are bigger physically, have more muscle mass than women, but these are not the essential qualities that go into being human, nor, as we will increasingly see, are they the most important qualities for being a ruler of a city. Perhaps you remember something that was intrinsic in the founding of the city way back in Book 2. If you recall, that was the original city, the city of minimal needs. That was the very simple city that was organized around a very primitive division of labor scheme: farmer, shoemaker, carpenter. One of the notions implicit in that scheme is that a person takes on the job that they are most qualified to take on. You take on the job that for which you have a natural aptitude. As we're going to see ever more clearly, the most important feature of being a ruler is intelligence. And we've just heard from Socrates that there's nothing in a woman's nature that in any way makes her less apt to fulfill that job. Let's take a step back and think about this proposal. And let me frame the question in the following way. Was Plato a feminist? Many scholars have answered yes, he was. And I think we can see why. He is arguing for, in the Republic, for the radical equality of men and women. On that score alone, some people would say he qualifies as being a feminist. Certainly within the context, as I've mentioned, of ancient Greek society, this is all the more striking since women were really kept at home, almost physically and literally kept at home in ancient Greece. Is that true, however, that Plato is a feminist? Well, let me suggest a counter-argument that I certainly won't solve this debate, but it might assist you in thinking about it. There are some feminists who would disagree with this characterization of Plato's feminist. They would claim that, in fact, Plato was not a feminist. And that's because he holds to just what I was describing a few minutes ago, namely an essentialist conception of human nature. There's one way to be human, and that's to be a person who learns, a person who uses reason, a person who acquires knowledge. There are many contemporary feminists who would reject such essentialist conceptions of human nature. And they would do so because they might argue that by homogenizing human nature in this fashion, Plato is denying to women those attributes that are, in fact, distinctly feminine. So some might argue that women are different from men, and that this difference needs to be affirmed, and that in order to be a feminist, one must affirm just those differences that Plato rejects as merely accidental. A second way, a more hostile way, that a feminist might approach Plato on this score is to say to Plato, yes, Plato, you give women equality, but the equality you give them is really just the chance to be like a man. Sure, you can rule the city, but you'll rule the city the way men rule the city. You can be a soldier, and that's a man's job. Therefore, once again, some critics of Plato might suggest that he's not a feminist at all, precisely because he obliterates these distinctions between men and women. I'm certainly not going to settle this issue. I can't in this lecture, but I would urge you to think about it. Let's move to the second wave, the second series of issues that Socrates has to take up in order to address this challenge that's been given to him by Adeimantus and the other young men who won't let him leave. The second wave, and I'm referring to 457D, is familiar to us. To paraphrase it, I would describe it as sexual communism. This is precisely what we were talking about initially. No woman will live privately with any man. No man will live privately with any woman. Don't forget that the guardians of Socrates' city don't have private homes to begin with, so this is a foregone conclusion. Children will not be raised by their biological parents. They will be raised communally. Parents will not know who their children are. Children will not know who their parents are. All of sexual and familial relationships will be subsumed under the city. Private interests will disappear. Public interest will replace it. Going immediately together with this proposal is another notion we are familiar with and perhaps we are uncomfortable with, and that's the notion of eugenics. because sexual relationships are all taking place under the auspices of the city, the city's rulers will make sure, as far as they are able, to forge a class of citizens who are excellent. They will, and perhaps you remember from The Noble Lie, this is exactly the language that's used there, they will make sure that gold-souled men mate with gold-souled women, and by doing so, increase the ranks of the most excellent people in the city. They will, if a silver child is born from a gold-souled parent, they will take the child away and put it in its proper place. Sexual reproduction will be completely run by the rulers of the city. And that process is all taking place under the label of what I'm calling eugenics. You can look at 459D for just those points. There's a very interesting small point I want to make about this, or that Socrates makes about this, and that is he says that the citizens of his city aren't going to like this very much. That's hardly surprising. And so once again, the rulers are going to lie to the citizens. This has been an issue for some time now in the Republic. Is it permissible for a ruler to lie to the citizens when the lie is for the benefit of the whole city? Socrates repeatedly says yes. People will not like the idea that rulers are choosing their sexual partners, rulers are determining their sexual reproductive patterns, and so Socrates recommends that there be a fake lottery, so that you would pick a lottery ticket and then you would find out who your sexual partner will be for that afternoon. You can look at 460A for this point. Socrates says we will fabricate a lottery so that people think that their sexual lives are being run by chance and not by the dictates of an authoritarian regime. I think this is suggestive. It at least shows us that Socrates understands that there's something terribly uncomfortable about his program of eugenics. It's very easy for us to criticize Socrates on these issues. This sort of regulation of sexual life seems to deny a basic freedom and a basic feature of being human. It subordinates individual love to the well-being of the city. A further problem that Aristotle, Plato's great student, writes about in Book 2 of his Politics is that it likely will make incest unavoidable. After all, parents don't know who their children are. Children don't know who their parents are. These are all very powerful criticisms. Before simply rejecting Socrates' proposals, however, I urge you to remember his justification for them. Let me read a couple of quotes which I think capture the spirit of the justification very, very well. At 462A, we find the following. Have we any greater evil for a city than what splits it and makes it many instead of one? In other words, all of the proposals that Socrates has offered us, really from the beginning of Book 2, have been in the service of a single ideal, and that is political solidarity. Nothing is worse, Socrates seems to believe, than faction, than civil strife, than internal discord. Now, this may not strike us with such force, but it certainly would have struck Plato with such force, because never forget that when he was 25 years old in the year 404, he witnessed his own city undergoing civil trauma, civil war, the tyranny, and then the subsequent overthrow of the tyranny. Like many political philosophers, he fears civil war above all else. And I think this is the kind of justification he would give for his extraordinarily radical proposals concerning sexual relationships. Two more quotes to help focus this argument. He says the following. is the city in which most people say my own and not my own about the same thing the best governed city, 462C. The just city is, quote, a community of pleasures and pains, 464A. I think both those quotes, again, make the point. The obliteration of the family, which may seem to be a very high price to pay, nonetheless, it will have a benefit, namely solidarity, a community of pleasures and pains. If we are all related to each other in this fashion, if none of us has a private mother or a private father or private children, we identify the city as our parent. You recall, again, the first part of the noble lie. We were born, Socrates says, from the earth. The earth is our parent. The city is our parent. Those people we simply identify as biological parents are not our real parents. The gain that Socrates envisions is a community in which self-interest is equivalent to public interest. I'm certain that many of you now are very critical of Socrates and quite uncomfortable and, again, perhaps even hostile to what you're hearing. You're thinking, and it's not a wrong thought, that Socrates sounds like a totalitarian. He sounds like a fascist, someone who argues for the supremacy of the state in all matters. Let me just give you a word of encouragement. Please be patient. If you stick with the Republic, if you get as far as Book 8, which I certainly hope you will do, you'll find that Socrates himself will become self-critical of his own proposals. So before making a judgment, please read the entire Republic. Let's move to the third wave. And you recall that the third wave in the nautical legend is the most intense, the biggest, the most difficult to swim through. The first two waves have very explicitly concerned women and sexual relationships. The third wave, when you first hear it, will seem to come out of nowhere. And it's the following, 473D. Philosophers must be rulers. Philosophers must be kings. That's the way it's always translated, but I think we now know the better way to put it would be philosophers must be kings and queens, because men and women equally share positions of rulership. Two questions to ask about this third wave. The first is, how in the world is it connected to the first two waves, each of which concern sexual relationships and women? Seems, as I said, to come out of nowhere and to be utterly disconnected from the previous two. If that's the case, it's a real failure as a metaphor, since the very notion of the three waves seemingly was indicating a unified set of ideas. Second question to ask about the third wave is, how in the world could philosophers be kings and queens? What is it about philosophy that would make someone into a ruler? These are difficult questions. They're going to occupy us for a good long while. I turn next to the lines 473E to 474A, because this is, for me at least, one of the most extraordinary scenes in the whole Republic, one of the strangest. Glaucon, Socrates' young companion, he is the brother of Adeimantus, the brother of Plato. Glaucon hears the third wave, that philosophers must be rulers, and to use a colloquialism, he goes ballistic. He's amazed, he's outraged at this proposal, and he says something that, for me, is quite memorable. He says, Socrates, and of course I'm paraphrasing, Socrates, how can you say this? When you say this, here's what's going to happen. Men who hear you say this are going to be so outraged by what you've said that they are going to rip off their clothes, pick up whatever happens to be ready at hand, whether it's a chair, a table, a club, a knife, and they're going to attack you. This conjures up the odd image of Socrates, who just said something which sounds perhaps preposterous, but not all that offensive, namely, philosophers should be rulers. We see him now being attacked by this small army of outraged, naked men who are armed with all sorts of peculiar weapons. What's the point of this scene? Well, minimally, it's this: to highlight the strangeness and the extraordinary importance of this third wave. And indeed, it is important because it's going to send us on a very long detour in the Republic. It's going to force us, as we'll see in the next couple of lectures, it's going to force us to ask the question, what is philosophy? Let me return to the question I mentioned just a couple of minutes ago, a preliminary reflection on the third wave. What connects the third wave, philosophers should be rulers, to the first two waves? The answer to that question, or at least a clue to the answer of that question, comes in the very word philosophy. In Greek, what it literally means is love of wisdom. In other words, philosophy, as Socrates construes it, is an erotic enterprise. That's perhaps an unfamiliar way of characterizing philosophy. Remember what the word eros means. Its primary meaning is sexual desire. It can also be translated as love. Philia, the first part of the word philosophy, also means love. A philosopher is animated by love, by passion, by eros. And that's the connecting link between the three waves. They're all, three of them, about eros. Let me spend a few minutes just trying to elaborate on this notion that philosophy is an erotic enterprise. This was a theme that was foreshadowed at the very beginning of the Republic in Book One. Perhaps you remember, Socrates enters the home of the old man, Cephalus. He asks Cephalus this rude, intrusive question, what's it like to be old? What's it like, in other words, to be about to die? And Cephalus surprisingly says, it's not so bad. I actually kind of like it. Why do you like it? I like it because I no longer suffer the passions of youth. I no longer suffer erotic madness. In the old days when I was a young man, eros used to drive me crazy. I would fall madly in love. I don't feel that anymore, says Cephalus. And you know what? I'm glad. I'm calm. I'm collected. I no longer feel like a crazy man. That scene sets the stage for much that follows in the Republic. Recall a few other points we discussed in Book One. After exchanging a few remarks with Cephalus, Socrates extracts from him a definition of justice. Remember, Cephalus says, another reason I'm not afraid to die is that I've always told the truth, I've always paid back my debts, and as a result, I'm not fearful of punishment in the next world. And Socrates says to him, aha, so is this what you mean by justice? Is this your definition of justice? Telling the truth and giving back what you're owed. Now, when we were discussing Book One, I said to you, I've always imagined Cephalus being shocked when Socrates extracts this definition of justice from his rather casual remarks. He has no intention of giving a definition of justice, and when Socrates pushes him just a little bit to try to work on this definition, Cephalus leaves. He says, I've had enough. I'm going to perform some religious sacrifices. This is not my idea of a pleasant afternoon. He leaves. He's smiling. He hands the conversation over to his younger, more energetic, more erotic son, Polemarchus. Now, what I would like you to wonder about a little bit is just this exchange between Socrates and Cephalus on the question, what is justice? Think about it in terms of two important themes of our whole course. The first is the what is it question, the question for which Socrates was famous. It's a question that demands a definition. A definition requires us to give a universal account of something. The example I gave was a hat. If I ask you, what is a hat? You have to give a definition of the hat, and that definition should account for every single individual hat. The demands on a definition are very intense. It must be universal. It must be comprehensive. Definitions are hard to come by. On your own, try to define a hat. Try to define a chair. Try to define a car. It won't be easy. You'll eventually succeed because these are not very complicated or obscure entities. Now try this. Try defining justice. What is justice? Very, very hard question. A question, as we are seeing in our own study of the Republic, that requires a tremendous commitment. We've been working on this question for the entirety of the Republic. What that suggests to me is that the question itself requires what? It requires passion, intellectual passion. In order to pursue this question, you must be driven by love. Love of what? Love of knowledge. Love of wisdom. If you're not energized by a passion as strong as love, you simply won't pursue the question. I think this is why Plato crafts that first scene so carefully. Cephalus is the foil. He's the example of the non-philosopher. Who are the examples of potential philosophers? Polemarchus, a young man filled with spirit, aggressive. Glaucon, Adeimantus, Plato's brothers, young men. Socrates likes to associate with young men, and I think now we can say why. He needs to be around people who are filled with erotic energy, who have sufficient intellectual passion to pursue the most difficult of all questions, such as, what is justice?
Lecture 10, Book 5, Who is the Philosopher?
We saw in the last lecture that Glaucon is terribly puzzled, perhaps even outraged, at the notion of the philosopher king, the third wave that Socrates proposes. The next task facing Socrates, therefore, is to give Glaucon a full explanation of philosophy, and he begins by what you might almost call a personality sketch of the philosopher. Who is this person? What sort of human being is he or is she? The key to understanding this personality, again, as I suggested in the previous lecture, will be concerning this person's erotic makeup, if I can use that word. What this person loves, because philosophy is philosophia, love of wisdom. The philosopher is a certain kind of human being who has a certain kind of love. I think what Plato finally believes is that each of us can be characterized by what we love. We are what we love, and a philosopher loves wisdom. Socrates, in giving his exposition of who the philosopher is, begins at 474c and right away focuses on the question of love. He says, I quote, "When we say a man loves something, he must love all of it." Often you'll see the gendered word man used. Sometimes that's true to the Greek, sometimes it's not. Remember always, however, that Plato is opening the doors to philosophy and to rule to both men and women. Socrates says the following as well, 475b. He makes an analogy between the lover of wisdom and the lover of wine. A wine lover, he says, loves all of wine. Similarly, a wisdom lover is, I quote, a desirer of wisdom, not of one part, but all of it. The person who eagerly approaches any form of learning, any form of wisdom, is to be counted as a lover of wisdom. Glaucon objects, and he has a very straightforward and very reasonable objection to make. He says to Socrates that this characterization of a philosopher is not specific enough. After all, lots and lots and lots of people love learning of different kinds. Glaucon and Socrates talk about people whom they call lovers of sights or lovers of hearing. That line is 475D. Think for a moment about who could be a lover of sights. By the way, I think the plural is very important, lover of sights, plural. Think of a tourist, a world traveler, someone who loves to travel and see new places, go to exotic countries, meet new kinds of people, discover cultures that he or she had never known about before. Isn't such a person to be counted as a lover of learning, a lover of wisdom? What about an archaeologist or an anthropologist who just, again, loves to discover facts about older cultures? Who then might be a lover of hearing? Somebody who loves to go to lectures. There are people who, for example, live in a university town and go to lectures of all kinds. The lecture could be on philosophy or history or science. They just love to absorb new information. Glaucon's point, in other words, is entirely well taken. Socrates' characterization of philosophy as the love of all of wisdom is not nearly specific enough. Socrates responds, and I'm going to quote directly from the text because this is a very important line, comes from 476b. He says the following, "The lovers of hearing and lovers of sight surely delight in beautiful sounds and colors and shapes, but their thought is unable to see and delight in the nature of beauty itself." The very last word is the key. Itself. Beauty itself. Lovers of sights, my example was of the world traveler, they love to accumulate information. They love to see many, many, many particular beautiful things. They have no interest in beauty itself. They, therefore, are not philosophers. And we'll explain why in just a couple of minutes. By contrast, a philosopher is, as Socrates puts it at 475e, a lover of the sight of truth. Analogous to a lover of sights, plural, this time it's singular, and the sight is not of particular beautiful objects, the sight is of the truth. Socrates says the following about the lover of the sight of truth, the philosopher, he or she, quote, believes that there is something beautiful itself and is able to catch sight both of it and of what participates in it, and doesn't believe that what participates is it itself, nor that it itself is what participates. 476D. That's a potentially confusing line. I suggest we concentrate on it and think about it pretty carefully, because in those couple of lines that I've read, what we are finding is a preliminary sketch of what scholars call Plato's theory of forms. Plato is as famous for the theory of forms as he is for anything else. In fact, the theory of forms is often used to organize Plato's career. Most scholars believe that Plato's work can be divided up into three periods: the early Plato, the middle Plato, and the late Plato. In the early stages of his career, Plato was very much in thrall to the historical Socrates, the actual man who lived 469 to 399. He wrote dialogues that imitate the historical Socrates. Again, this is the scholarly theory. By his middle stage, he had developed his own theory, the theory of forms, and perfected it or even went beyond it in his late stage. The Republic is the great work of Plato's middle period. It's the flowering of the theory of forms. In the lines I read just a while back, we got a sketch of it. And so let's think about it pretty carefully. First, let's start by thinking about the word for form. In your text, by the way, there'll be two English words, the English word form and the English word idea. They refer to two different Greek words. The word form translates the Greek word eidos, and the word idea translates the Greek word idea. But those two Greek words, eidos and idea, actually are almost synonyms. They really are synonyms, in the Republic at least. They are both derived from a verb which means to see. So I will use, as will most of your translators, the English word form and the English word idea synonymously. They both refer to the same thing. Now, I mentioned the etymology of the Greek words because it's the great clue as to what the word form means. The most literal way to translate eidos is look. And here I'm using look not as a verb, but as a noun. The look of a thing, the way a thing looks. If you read Homer, you'll see this Greek word eidos. He will be using it in a way to describe exactly what I've just said, the way somebody looks. If Menelaus, for example, the great king who we find in the Iliad and the Odyssey, is described as a great man and very handsome in his eidos, the way he looks. Now, this notion of the look of a thing is a pretty helpful clue when you try to figure out the philosophical meaning of the word eidos or form. Let me just exemplify this by pointing to a very common object, a chair. If you are sitting in a room and there are four or five pieces of furniture around a table, you don't have any trouble identifying what they are. They are all chairs. Well, how do you know they're chairs? They look like chairs. They have the same shape. Another word that comes very close to being synonymous with form. Now, imagine you are at a dining room table and there are six chairs around the table. The chairs could each be composed of different material. One is wood, one is plastic, one is metal. They might be different shapes, slightly. They might have a longer or a shorter back, etc. But the overall look of the thing is the same, and that's why they're counted as one and the same thing. Six individual chairs, one form, one look, chair. Go back to the quote that I suggested was so important at 476D. A form is a universal. The other way that Socrates regularly talks about forms is to use this pronoun itself, which I highlighted a minute ago. I'm going to reread 476D, or at least a part of it. The philosopher, the lover of the sight of truth, and this is the contrast with the lover of sights, believes that there is something beautiful itself. The philosopher has his or her eye on the form. And above all else, what the philosopher doesn't get confused about, and now I'm back in the quote, the philosopher doesn't believe that what participates in the form is the form, and doesn't believe that the form somehow participates in anything else. Let me explain what that means. The hard word, and probably the hardest single concept to understand in Plato's theory of forms, is the word participates. Let's use Socrates' example of beauty itself. He believes that beauty itself is a form. So all these phrases now are synonymous. Beauty itself, the idea of beauty, the form of beauty, these are universal. Now, there are many, many beautiful things in the world. A beautiful sunset, a beautiful painting, a beautiful face, a beautiful piece of music. All of those are particulars. They're very different from each other, but they have one feature in common, and of course that feature is they are all beautiful. Why are they all beautiful? Socrates' answer is because they participate, the key word, in the form of beauty. Another phrase you might use to illustrate what this notion of beauty itself means is absolute beauty. The philosopher is focused on beauty itself, or justice itself, or any of the other forms, and doesn't have very much interest in those particular exemplifications of the form. The philosopher is more interested in beauty itself than in the beautiful painting, more interested in beauty itself than in the beautiful sunset. It's the lover of sights, plural, who's interested in beautiful sunset, beautiful painting, beautiful X, Y, Z, not the philosopher. Let me give you two technical philosophical words that are widely used in English, both of which derive from the Greek. A form is ontologically and epistemologically prior to the particular. They are before the particular, they are superior to the particular. Let me explain these two words. Particular instances of the forms depend on the form. They get their being or their reality from the form. It's by participation that the beautiful painting becomes beautiful. The Greek word for being is to own. That's one of the ways Greek would express the phrase being. Ontological, therefore, means having to do with being or reality. So the reality of the painting, the beautiful painting, sunset, etc., depend for their reality, their being, on the form of beauty. This is a notion that is very hard for many people to accept, because it suggests that beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty is absolute. Beauty is objective. Beauty is embodied in the form, not the particulars. The forms are epistemologically superior to the particulars as well. They are prior and superior. To know that a painting is beautiful requires me to be able to refer to the form of beauty in order to demonstrate that this painting is truly beautiful. The Greek word episteme means knowledge and is the root of our word epistemological. So in both these senses, ontological and epistemological, the forms are superior. Let me give you another angle or a way to think about Plato's theory of forms. I would suggest that Plato's theory of forms relies on a certain conception of language. Just reflect momentarily on the words we use when we speak. The most striking feature of them, whether they're nouns or adjectives, is that they have a general or universal reference. When I talk about the chair, I am talking about a concept that is beyond any individual chair. The word chair that I use doesn't refer only to this particular chair right here. No word in our language ever refers only to a single particular. All words have a universal, general meaning. Or to use examples that are from adjectives. Go back to the standard example of this lecture, beautiful. I talk about the beautiful painting, but I'm not, when I use the word beautiful, referring only to the painting. I can use that very same word to refer to the beautiful sunset. So the word beautiful has, yet again, a very general meaning. Now, I would suggest that the inspiration of Plato's theory of forms is reflection on language. Plato believes, and many philosophers would agree with him, many philosophers would disagree with him, Plato believes that there are objects to which these words of ours refer. And as I've just mentioned, our words don't have a particular reference, they have a universal reference. So, simply because we discuss beautiful things in the world suggests to Plato that there must be something to correspond to that word we use when we're discussing so many different things. There must be unity. That's a very basic philosophical impulse, at least in terms of Greek philosophy, and it's very, very sharp in Plato. Because I use adjectives to describe so many different objects, there must be a unifying principle, there must be a being which stands behind this word that I use, and that being is the form. Let me remind you of a character we met a pretty long time ago, Thrasymachus from Book 1 of the Republic. And I mention him because he was a sophist, and he therefore, because he was a sophist, would radically disagree with what Socrates is saying. Thrasymachus would reject the theory of forms. And I thought it might be useful just to spend a couple of minutes discussing that, again, to give you an inkling of what this theory of forms really entails. Recall a word I used to describe the sophists in general, Thrasymachus in particular. He is a relativist. His definition of justice was, justice is the advantage of the stronger. Now this is, as we discussed when we were talking about Book 1, a relativizing definition because it forces justice to be different in every single regime. So in a democracy, the stronger are the people, because the people vote in the leaders, the people choose their own leaders. In a democracy, what is just is what is advantageous to the people. In a tyranny, what is just would be what is advantageous to the tyrant. And these could be very different things. So in a tyranny, freedom of speech would be counted as a bad thing. In a democracy, freedom of speech would be counted as a good thing. That is the essence of Thrasymachus's relativism. What that suggests about sophists or relativists is that they simply reject the Platonic move to assert that there is a universal object like beauty itself. To think about this in strictly linguistic terms, you might think of the sophist as really not liking that little pronoun itself. They don't like that word itself. There is no justice itself. There is no beauty itself, no goodness itself. Beauty for the sophists is in the eyes of the beholder. Beauty for Plato is not in the eyes of the beholder. It's in the form, in absolute beauty. If you and I are debating about two paintings in a museum, and I say the first painting is beautiful, and you say the first painting is ugly, and then you say the second painting is beautiful and I disagree with you, according to Plato, at least theoretically, there's a right answer to the question. That's what it means to say beauty is not in the eyes of the beholder. It's not simply a matter of taste. It's a matter of objective knowledge. Just as there is a right answer to the question, what is 2 plus 2? It equals 4. So too is there a right answer to the question, which painting is more beautiful? Answer, the one that's closer to the form of beauty, the idea of beauty. Now, I would like to make a very expansive claim at this stage of the lecture. I would suggest to you that this debate about language and the meaning of the general words that we always use in language